so many of the people that come here have been drinking to self-medicate the mental illness that they've suffered for years.
A new report brings hope for assisting homeless alcoholics. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a former state deputy commissioner jumps into the lieutenant governor race.
I'm Alaska Native, so I'm going to be talking with Alaska Natives about what's important to them, but we're going to try to take a look at this as an entire package.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Karluk Manor, an apartment complex for homeless alcoholics in Anchorage, has been open nearly 2 years. Officials say the program is starting to make a difference. Preliminary findings by researchers at the University of Alaska seem to confirm their observations. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
It's almost mealtime, and Bob Thomas is getting ready to serve the residents of Karluk Manor dinner.
Lunch from 11 to 12, and then dinner is from 4 to 5.
Thomas works 4 days a week, 8 hours a day, and makes less than $10 an hour.
I clean up after lunch and dinner, and then I wipe the table, sweep the floor, mop.
Thomas not only works at Karluk, he's also a resident. The 52-year-old became homeless in the spring of 2000 after his mother, whom he'd been living with and caring for, passed away. Her house sold within a couple of weeks, and before he knew it, the grief-stricken son was on the street. He set up a tent near Cheney Lake. More than a decade of alcohol-fueled problems, cold nights, and scary situations followed.
Kids would come by and throw rocks, or booby-trap the tent, or like one time we were camping and there was kids right by our tent, and they were throwing butcher knives from each side at our tent.
He bounced from camp to camp, Cheney Lake to Muldoon, downtown and back again. He tried other programs to get sober and get off the street, but nothing worked. In December 2011, Thomas was one of the first residents to move into Karluk Manor, a housing-first facility for homeless alcoholics who are not yet ready to quit drinking. Now, he says, he's sober. Helen Fleming is proud of the progress that Thomas and other residents like him have made. She's the housing supervisor at Karluk. The majority of residents have reduced their drinking, she says, and now some are beginning to address other problems.
They then start addressing some of the mental health issues that might be going on. That happens a lot because so many of the people that come here have been drinking to self-medicate the mental illness that they've suffered for years. We have people who are seeing their therapist, seeing their doctor, seeing a psychiatrist, getting medications.
Janet Johnston, an assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Alaska Institute for Circumpolar Health Studies, says preliminary data from a study she's working on backs up what residents and employees of Karluk are seeing.
Since the numbers are small, you know, I have to stress that this is really preliminary, but we have seen some changes in the frequency of drinking. So we've got a larger percentage of people who are drinking, once a week or less in the follow-up than we had at baseline, and a smaller percentage who are drinking every day.
Residents of Karluk are also using the emergency room less and instead getting medical care through regular doctor's appointments, Johnston says. The preliminary results of the Karluk study do not surprise Melinda Freeman, who manages the program for Rural Cap.
Well, I'm very, very excited about the growth and potential that we are seeing in the tenants at Karluk Manor. We studied this model for several years before we attempted to get the funding and the building and rehabbing the building. So we were very prepared to launch a Housing First program in Alaska.
It costs approximately $1 million per year to operate Karluk Manor. The money comes in part from the residents themselves. 30% of their income is used to help with costs, and the rest is a mix of federal sources. Studies of Housing First facilities in other states show, on average, residents reduce their drinking by about 30% once they have stable housing. Thomas says he's grateful to have another chance.
I'm working on being a success story, and I know of at least two or three other people in here. They say when you get Housing First, you reduce it at least 30%. Well, I probably reduce mine 80%.
As a result of reducing his drinking, Thomas says he's getting healthier and setting goals. In addition to his job at Carluck, he also does day labor construction. He's paying back child support from missed payments while he was homeless. Through the phone in his room, he's reconnecting with his three grown children and getting to know his grandchild. He's stopped drinking, but sometimes falls off the wagon, he admits. He knows his sobriety is tenuous.
When I was homeless all that time, I was drinking 3 pips a day, every day. But now I can't even drink 1 pip. I mean, I tried that 6 weeks ago, I did. I was starting to drink a bottle, but my tolerance is so low now that I didn't even get halfway through it. And I just caught myself and turned it right around, and because I just look out there and I don't want to go back to that again.
Thomas says he's focusing on staying sober for now and reconnecting with family, but he says he hopes to eventually get his driver's license back, buy a truck, and start his own business. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
With cold temperatures right around the corner, Anchorage's main homeless shelter is reviving a former time limit rule. After 30 days, Brother Francis Shelter will make people leave for another 30 if they have not complied with shelter rules. It's called the 30-day in, 30-day out policy. Ellen Kersnack is a spokeswoman for Brother Francis Shelter. She says there are simply too many people using the shelter as a residence.
The 30-day in, 30-day out policy acknowledges that the shelter is an emergency shelter not intended as a long-term residence. We're encouraging people to move on to permanent housing. We are a safety net, and the idea is that we are there for them for 30 days as in an emergency situation.
Brother Francis Shelter is located near downtown. Kersnack says the policy actually dates back to 1993, but the shelter lifted it 2 years ago when the municipality raised the temperature at which shelters could take in the homeless from 32 to 45 degrees. Since then, Kersnack says they've been operating at capacity and there have been increasing problems with security. People staying at the shelter can get an extension to stay beyond 30 days, but they must be working on a plan to get permanent housing.
They need to meet with a case manager and follow a guide, a housing guide, for permanent housing. Part of that is employment. It may be treatment to overcome whatever those barriers are to get into permanent housing.
The municipality raised the temperature limit, and Brother Francis lifted the 30-day in, 30-day out policy back in 2012 to prevent outdoor deaths. Kersnack says shelter officials have held 2 town halls to let people know about the rule change.
We want people to be safe. We want people to be warm. But we also want them to look at Brother Francis as an emergency shelter, as its intention. But we have to have some way to encourage them to move forward with a permanent housing plan.
Kersnack says Brother Francis Shelter has increased case management hours and is allowing drop-in appointments to help residents find permanent housing. Alaska's Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game, Craig Fleener, has resigned his post to run for Lieutenant Governor. Independent candidate for Governor Bill Walker held a press conference this afternoon in Fairbanks to help Fleener launch his campaign.
I am so honored and humbled to introduce my running mate, my friend, and my fellow Alaskan, Craig Fleener.
Candidates for governor and lieutenant governor run separately, but Walker said as independents, he and Fleener will campaign as a team. Craig Fleener is Gwich'in Athabascan from Fort Yukon. Wearing a traditional beaded moose hide vest and surrounded by family, including his wife and baby son, Fleener offered a diverse portrait of who he is.
I'm a Marine Corps veteran. I'm an Alaska Guardsman. I'm a biologist. I'm a firefighter. I'm a fur buyer. I'm an aircraft mechanic. And I'm even a janitor. I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a Christian. I'm a moose hunter and a woodcutter, and even packed some water from the river a few times.
Fleener struck familiar political themes of bringing people together and bridging the urban-rural divide. As former Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game, Fleener said he knows the challenge of managing Alaska's fish and game in a state where everyone is entitled equal access.
In particular, of course, I'm Alaska Native, so I'm going to be talking with Alaska Natives about what's important to them. But we're going to try to take a look at this as an entire package. Subsistence is important for a lot of people around Alaska, and so we're going to have to pull everyone together to talk about solutions.
Fleener pointed to his lack of political affiliation as a strong attribute.
I think that I have purposely chosen to not affiliate with a party because I like the freedom to take a look at each and every candidate. Like I wish all Alaskans would do. I wish you'd take a look at each candidate and say, that's my guy because I believe in him, because he has an open tent and everyone's welcome and is willing to hear ideas, share ideas, and come up with solutions together.
Fleener said he has no axes to grind with the state and left his job on good terms. Bill Walker has been critical of the Parnell administration. He's known for his long advocacy on behalf of a gas line from the North Slope to Valdez and his opposition to state oil tax reductions. He says Fleener broadens his oil and gas focus.
It was brought to my attention in many parts of Alaska that there are other issues that are as equal or greater than that to others in Alaska. So we need a broader range of focus in the governor's office.
Fleener and Walker have to collect signatures to get their names on the 2014 ballot as independent candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. Governor Sean Parnell has appointed the director of the Alaska State Troopers as acting public safety commissioner. Colonel Keith Mallard will take over for Joe Masters, who last month announced his resignation after 5 years as commissioner. Masters' resignation was to be effective tomorrow. According to biographical information provided by Parnell's office, Mallard has worked for the Public Safety Department for 16 years. He transferred to the Alaska Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement in 2005, serving as deputy commander. A year later, he was promoted and assigned as the commander of the agency, where he served until December 2010. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at smoking rates among teens.
I'm tired of seeing our people wash their faces with their tears because so many people die of cancer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ERA, for more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Teen smoking has fallen significantly in the last 6 years. That's the finding of a new state report. But as APRN's Josh Edge reports, there's still work to be done.
Overall, smoking rates among teenagers have dropped by 40%. But Alaska Native youth smoke at twice the rate of non-Native teens.
I'm tired of seeing our people wash their faces with their tears because so many people die of cancer.
That's Lincoln Bean, the vice chair of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. His life, like many others, has been affected by smoking and the health issues that often accompany it.
Just before July, my ex-wife passed away from cancer weighing 84 pounds. And now her son is stage 2 with lung cancer. A young man. These stories need to be told to our young people. This is a deadly habit.
He encourages Alaska's Native leaders to take the lead on continuing to deter youths from smoking.
Smoking tobacco is not a part of our traditional culture in Alaska. Not that I'm aware of, and I've been around for a while.
Nearly 20% of Alaska Native youths reported smoking within the last month, down from more than 30% in 2007. Dr. Ward Hurlburt, the state's chief medical officer, says the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention typically ranks Alaska first among states for its efforts to reduce youth tobacco use. And he says those efforts are working.
These are great numbers. It's wonderful news. And while it's encouraging to see these numbers moving in the right direction and having moved this far, We also know that there remains much work to be done.
The 2013 Youth Risk Behavior Survey involved over 1,200 randomly selected students from across 43 of Alaska's public high schools. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Public opposition to a middle school sports travel ban adopted by the Juneau School Board last month continues to be one-sided. As Jeremy Shea reports, the anonymity of the ban's community supporters is breeding skeptics of the official explanation.
Floyd Dryden Middle School 8th grader Kathy Tran is one of many venting about the out-of-town travel ban and the way it was adopted.
They said that there was a lot of people that supported this ban, and I was like, who?
After interviewing more than a dozen board members, school officials, parents, and students, no one has been willing or able to answer that question. Not one person spoke in favor of the ban during public testimony at the school board's two meetings on the policy. Board members say there is community support for the ban, but are unwilling to identify from whom. Here's school board member Barbara Thurston, one of three no votes.
At this point, you know, we're hearing it off the record.
Meanwhile, the opposition is organizing. About 40 people picketed a school board meeting last month at Thunder Mountain High School. A Facebook group called Save Our Middle School Sports, created in February, has 209 members. And in a nearly empty room in a nearly empty mall on a Tuesday, a dozen people were putting together a repeal campaign. Jennifer Lindley, a Floyd Dryden mom and repeal organizer, says the school board acted undemocratically.
They voted in favor of an unspoken minority that none of us can seem to find. I don't know who my counterpart is.
School board members on both sides say there is no hidden agenda and that the board itself raised the travel policy issue. The four school board members who voted for the ban argue it reduces the burden on already strained budgets and reduces the fundraising borne by local businesses and the community. They say it eliminates unfair differences between how travel requests are handled at Juneau's two main middle schools. School Board Vice President Sean O'Brien says casting his yes vote was agonizing.
The challenge is we have an obligation to kind of create a relatively equitable playing field.
Floyd Dryden's principal uses a case-by-case approach, weighing the amount of time lost in the classroom against the potential benefits of travel. Santiki Heaney Middle School principal Molly Yerkes does not allow out-of-town sports travel. She says it's not right to spend so much time and effort arranging travel when staffing cuts have left her school without a full-time certified nurse and sometimes a single adult supervising 150 students at lunch. Neither principal asked the school board to weigh in, though Yerkes says she does support the ban because it clarifies district priorities. O'Brien says significant differences in kids' opportunities, like sports travel, could lead to other problems.
And you start having school shopping, you know, for parents over that.
School board member Lisa Worrell voted against the travel ban. She says the travel policy is one of many differences between the schools, for example, with classes offered and community involvement.
So there just is a real difference between the schools. I mean, there's no right and wrong. It just is.
Worrell says the travel ban sets a board precedent favoring uniformity over local control. If the budget and staffing situation changes, Yerkes expects the school board would lift the ban, and she says she would reinstitute out-of-town travel.
And so I think that Molly Yerkes has done the best that she can with what she has, and focus it on more of an intramural because that way she can get more kids to play in sports.
Opponents say the budget effects of out-of-town travel are negligible because it's paid for almost exclusively with fundraising. The school district pays indirect costs, such as substitutes for teachers traveling as coaches. They say if Juneau cannot or is not willing to support fundraising, it fails. The Juneau Chamber of Commerce, whose members independently bear much of that cost, has not taken a position. Seventh grader Leah Kleinman plays basketball at Floyd Dryden. The night the school board adopted the travel ban, she presented a 350-signature petition opposing it.
You play, you have fun, then you want to, like, travel somewhere. Cause it's like, hey, guys, go to Ketchikan, yeah. But now it's like, you're just going to stay there, and you're just going to play DZ. And then they will eventually stop coming to us.
That's already begun, even though the ban doesn't take full effect until next school year. Middle school officials in Ketchikan and Sitka say their athletes aren't as likely to come to Juneau if Juneau stops traveling. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the newly restored historic Anchorage Hotel. You can find out more about this boutique hotel in the heart of downtown at historicanchoragehotel.com. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
About 50 Alaska Army National Guard members will deploy to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The guardsmen from the 761st Military Police Battalion 38th Troop Command will serve about a year. The soldiers will join up with about 30 members of a subordinate unit who deployed in September for training in Texas ahead of the Guantanamo Bay assignment. The guardsmen will care for detainees and conduct intelligence collection, analysis, and dissemination. Hospital facilities throughout Southeast Alaska are getting old, with many closing in on 50 years. Healthcare has changed quite a bit in the past half century, and communities are facing expensive upgrades to keep up with those changes into the future. KRBD's Layla Carey has the story.
If you appreciate 1960s interior design elements, Ketchikan Medical Center's surgery rooms are for you. The cramped spaces are tiled in vintage green, and while there have been some upgrades in the past half century, it still looks like the set for a movie based in a bygone era.
So, I just want to give you an idea of 1963.
Kim Schwartz is the surgical services manager, and she's showing a small group of visitors a vintage item left over from the original construction. She opens up a little door in the wall and says,
"Does anybody know what that is?"
No.
What it is suction. And what you would do is you turn on water, water would go down through here, you'd have a hose on here, and that creates a vacuum.
So, but you don't use that.
No,
we don't use this anymore. But this is the kind of technology that there was in 1963 so that you could have suction.
That's Penny Peterson. She heads up the Ketchikan Medical Center Foundation, which is leading the effort to upgrade the community's primary healthcare facility. Peterson led a tour of the hospital to show its structural limitations, particularly in the surgery area, but she and Schwartz are quick to point out that it provides quality care despite those shortcomings.
The average infection rate across the nation is
about 3%.
3%.
In the operating room?
In the operating room areas. And we were at
zero.
While that is impressive, the facility needs are notable, and Ketchikan isn't alone. Karen Perdue is CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
As I travel around the state and look at hospitals in Alaska, I would say that the lower southeast is an area where the three hospitals that I can think of, Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg, are among the most aging of facilities that we see in the state.
Ketchikan's hospital is owned by the city and operated by Peace Health, a Catholic nonprofit medical provider that also manages facilities in Oregon and Washington. Southeast Alaska has a long history of communities working in partnership with nonprofit healthcare groups. Purdue says those communities have been careful about keeping up with routine maintenance. However,
at some point you just can't remodel enough to keep up with what the patients need. So that's what we're seeing in Southeast Alaska.
The city of Ketchikan has about $15 million from the state for its project, and voters just approved a ballot measure to take on $43 million in bonds, the amount still needed for the renovation's first phase. That's the largest, most expensive phase and will add about 72,000 square feet to the hospital and the Peace Health-run clinics. There have been some minor renovations since the mid-60s, including badly needed electric upgrades so fuses don't blow during surgeries, but the basic structure has remained the same. That's not the case a little further north. Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital was rebuilt in the 1960s and expanded in the 1980s.
The hospital is extremely well-equipped.
Jim Strader is Bartlett's Director of Community Relations and Marketing.
We have a state-of-the-art, brand-new critical care unit, which is not only state-of-the-art itself, but also connected. And we have telemedicine capabilities for additional specialist consultation, that sort of thing. The building is fairly new. It's modern. it's very well equipped.
Strader says any limitations at Bartlett are related more to services that lack sufficient demand, such as cardiology, rather than facilities that need upgrades. In Wrangell, though, it's a different story. Officials there want a whole new facility. Wrangell's hospital was built in 1968, and while there have been additions since then, an engineer determined that remodeling and expanding it would cost more than just building a new one. Purdue says upgraded facilities are important not just for patient care, but also for attracting and maintaining quality staff.
As our healthcare facilities age, providers, especially surgeons and people who are doing work in hospitals, are looking at that to say whether or not that's a place they want to invest in their intellectual capital in those communities.
So this room, this is when we're going to do, say, a lap chole in a room.
Back in Ketchikan's surgery suite, Schwartz has set up a room for a mock operation to demonstrate how little space there is. She explains that to maintain a sterile field, anyone moving around the patient has to stay a minimum distance and not touch anything draped in blue. And pretty much everything is draped in blue. She challenges Bette Jakubik, one of the tour participants, to go get an item from the other side of the room.
You have to be a fairly way with arms up.
How it works.
Jakubik weaves around equipment, knocks something over, and ducks under several cords. They like to call it surgical yoga.
And then you have to, like, scoot underneath
yep.
here?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or easy.
So you're trying to get there kind of fast, because you need it now.
Got it.
Good job. Now you got to come back again without touching any of the blue drapes, and you got to give it to your person that's scrubbing.
There were three on the tour that day, making five in the room. Schwartz says there usually are six, plus the patient and perhaps a family member. All of the renovation plans are geared toward improved care, a better experience for patients, and the ability to keep up with rapidly changing technology. The direct effect on the public, they say, will be that more patients will receive treatment close to home. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Many Alaskans are choosing to make energy efficiency improvements around their homes. Investing in efficient light bulbs or a programmable thermostat could save hundreds annually. For more tips on how to save money and energy, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.